And it was great because it played both ways. If people were pro-Australian, I could push the Australian-made down under thing. And if they preferred imports, well, we'd just ignore that and pretend it was German.
And hello, welcome to Not an Audio File, the podcast. Today is episode 7, season 1, and we're speaking to the founder of Richter Acoustics, Mr. Ralph Waters, ably assisted with, in fact, by his good friend, Brad Surhan, recalling some of the tales of yore, and of course myself, Andrew Hutchison. So without any further ado, part 1.
I do remember meeting Ralph,
right?
It was, you know what? I don't remember. I thought it was Trevor.
Make up your mind.
No, I thought it was Trevor Wilson possibly introduced us or something. I'm just, it's so hard. It is hard, but it's almost like we came out of this amorphous mass of. In about 85 or something like that, and Paul Keating was talking about the fact that we were going to become a banana, our nation's treasurer at the time was talking about us becoming a banana republic, and we had to start buying Australian products, and it was around 85, 86 that we, you know, started to get, Ralph and I started to get out there, but we must have bumped into each other at a hi-fi shop, surely, Ralph. And, you know,
well, like I said, Brad, I simply can't recall. All I know is that, I just can't recall that quintessential moment. It's lost to me.
I'm guessing it goes something like this. You, Ralph, were doing the good work of driving around to various dealers and showing off your wares, and Brad was following you around. He was
stalker style, a serial stalker.
store by store.
Yeah, store by store stalker.
In the hope that he might pick off a dealer that has said no to Ralph and maybe will take the alternate product instead. But, I mean, you, as far as starting, I mean, firstly, the name Richter, I guess, did you have some kind of small fetish for earthquake studies, or what? Where did the title come from? Do you think?
Okay, that is something that I do remember. It's a very significant name, Andrew.
Yes.
Because I discovered very early in the piece, when I was out talking with people and talking with dealers, is that they had almost contempt for anything that was made in Australia.
Wow, okay.
And that was the first thing that I noted. And secondly, I'm a bit like Brad. We love to play with words.
Yes.
He's a wordsmith. I'm a wordsmith. And... So the word Richter, the slogan was a force from down under.
Okay.
I remember. Yep.
Okay, so we have Richter, which could be German, but it's not. And the force from down under, which is obviously a play on words on the speaker from down under being Australia.
Yeah.
And it was great because it played both ways. If people were pro-Australian, I could push the Australian-made down under thing. And if they preferred imports, well, we'd just ignore that and pretend it was German. So it was a case of mistaken identity. Either way, it worked for me. So that's the basis of the name, and I've always said in marketing, what's in a name? Well, I think everything, actually, everything. If you get the wrong name, you know, it makes it very difficult for the product. Like if the product had been called RW, you know, it just wouldn't have the same resonance, wouldn't have the same pungence.
Yeah, couldn't agree more that you could set yourself up for a really hard task marketing a brand new brand if you've exactly. I mean, and a lot of people do that, of course. I mean, they're still doing it today, aren't they, Brad? So, yes. yeah, it's there's some classic examples of brands gone past that are, you know, pretty much just named after the founder, which sometimes work if they've got an interesting name. Maybe not so much in the case of Waters. Watery Acoustics probably doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well as Richter Acoustics does. But you at some point you must have made the decision. I mean, I'm assuming, rightly or wrongly, that you built a few speakers for your own amusement, and I guess they went well. Is that how you sort of decided that perhaps, you know, maybe making them commercially was for you?
No.
Okay. fair enough. Tell us how it happened.
That was a bad guess. I should finish the other question off too by saying that all the advertising that I put into shops, I had these big boards made up, and it had a little boy with no pants on, actually. He was just wearing a little shirt. He was about 2.5 years of age.
Mm.
And he was on an Australian beach. And behind him was the absolute first Holden car ever made in Australia.
48/215, wasn't it called? Pre the
X-ray. Yeah, that's it, exactly. And that was... that was the Australian part, and that little boy happened to be me.
Okay.
So it was just a cheeky way of saying, I'm Australian, I'm proud of it, and I'll push Australian however hard that I can, wherever possible. And I've always been that way, and I always shall.
Yeah, pants off style, Ralph. I love it. Pants off. Just get the tackle out and full steam ahead.
Yes, which boils back to the original observation.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, the second question that you asked was, I've forgotten, sorry.
Oh, it was sort of how you decided that you might start manufacturing loudspeakers commercially.
Okay, well, yeah. I never really started, Andrew.
I feel as if you might have, because the brand is still going today, so.
Like, I can't remember having... let's put it this way. Ever since I was a little boy, I was fascinated with music. I lived with my grandfather. He was a very accomplished concert pianist.
Okay.
And shared the same room with him. And he introduced me to a whole range of music. Everything from South Pacific through to Rachmaninoff. And I was always fascinated with how the sound of a piano and musical instruments and voices could come out of a piece of paper suspended between a bit of metal.
It is impressive.
And I was very fascinated with this. And ever since I was a little fella, I was always pulling things apart, and in speakers, I had just kept on pulling things apart and being fascinated with speakers and listening to them discreetly, and that was my living memory, and I'd never really stopped doing that, and it got to a point in time where actually a couple of things coincided. I was in a job, and I'd already started to sell a few speakers here and there. pretty well paid job, actually. I had a car and great conditions and so on. I just went into work one day and said, I'm resigning.
Okay.
I thought, what will I do now? I thought, oh, I don't know. I know, I'll start a loudspeaker company. So I did.
Well,
that's how it
so that,
that's it, how it began.
And yet the decision to resign from your job that probably offered a package of goodies far in excess of anything you'll ever have in the loudspeaker manufacturing business, your decision to resign was more about just because you were sick of that job and you were sort of subconsciously looking for a new challenge, do you think? Is that what that was?
Yeah. I get tired of things fairly easily, and I just sort of lost interest in it.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, time to move on.
Yeah.
Ralph, were you a psych? What were you a psychologist? Like, if you don't mind me asking, originally?
Yeah. I trained as a teacher because I didn't have the money to go into electrical engineering like my uncle. And so I did teacher training, not because I wanted to become a teacher, but because it was a free pass through university. I had a child at the time, and we were lush with cash because when my oldest baby came along, we on the scholarship that we're on, we actually received an extra dollar per week for the baby. So they funded our university career. And afterwards I thought, well, I'm a crummy teacher. What can I do now? Well, as it turned out, I jagged a scholarship to do a master's degree doing psychology, which seemed like a good exit toward a teaching. So I did that.
Yeah.
really, I wasn't all that interested in that either. I just, basically, it was a sequence of accidental events, and I thought, oh, I'm sick of all this. I resigned, and then I thought, okay, well, I'll start a loudspeaker company, which was absolute folly.
folly. What a great word.
I had no money.
I
had no idea what I was doing, basically, none whatsoever. But a little bit of background, I had been tinkering with my Commodore computer.
Yeah.
And I had been designing the bass performance of loudspeakers using a program which was written by Richard Small. And I started to correspond with him. He was at the University of New South Wales at the time. And then he went on to KEF loudspeakers, I think, to head their research division. And he sent me copies of their papers. And so even at that very, very early stage in about, 84, I was designing things at home just for the fun of it, using what was groundbreaking, revolutionary and world-leading technology devised right here in Australia by Neville Teal and Richard Small. So technically, even in the early days, I had that kind of edge, which was very handy. So although I went in blind, I was slightly equipped. I'd read the papers. I'd read a lot on acoustics so it was sort of like a natural next step, I guess.
I mean, you clearly had a strong interest in it to be doing that, and I would guess from afar that you clearly must have Richard Small must have cottoned on to the fact that you had an understanding and a strong interest for the backwards and forth that was going on, which I mean, you immediately think you were emailing him, but of course it was the 80s and you were, I don't know, were you sending him letters or ringing him up? How was the communication happening?
I wrote to him, it was by letter. I didn't actually speak to him. I think I only had one or two conversations with him, but excuse me, I was just recovering from the flu. So it was all by correspondence.
Yeah. It's how it was done. I mean, it's kind of forgotten, and so you, the fact that you were using software that early. I just wonder how many serious manufacturers were really even in the mid 80s. I mean, they would have had some very expensive measurement equipment, chart recorders, what have you. But I mean, how many people do you think do you remember the name of the software? Was it something that Richard Small had kind of written, or was it what was the product that was running on your Commodore 64 that was booting off a cassette drive or something?
Well, you're going to laugh. The original equations were translated into a series of commands, and they were published in the back of a Radio Shack design book on loudspeakers.
Oh man, what, the Red Book?
The Red Book.
That's it.
The Red Book. I mean, Chairman Mao has.
Have a look at the back.
Book. Yeah, I unfortunately, I don't think I have that book anymore. I think I've got all of the books that I bought except that one, which is kind of frustrating. But I think I bought it when it was like 12 or something. So it's been lost in, you know, I don't know. It's gone. But I have vague memories of some base. We're talking BASIC, I guess. Is that the programming language? Is that what it was?
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know anything about BASIC, but I had a friend who did, and he programmed up the the Commodore Trash 80, I think it was, and
Trash 80.
The program was actually fed in via a cassette tape. It was all very...
yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
The TRS 80, Trash 80, or the Totally Ratshit 80, I think, were the two joke... titles, but
anyway, that's
amazing.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because both I'm going to drop my buffhead in here and say that Dick Small, Ralph, I went and saw Dick Small. I thought it was at Sydney Uni because that's where I was studying initially, and went and knocked on his door, and he gave me some formulas, Ralph. This was 1979 or 80, but he was very patient, and I only saw him once. The fact is, it seems like he was very generous and open to sharing information. It's really good to hear. I didn't know that you had that those conversations, inverted commas, with Richard Small. It's bloody marvellous. Get that.
We should acknowledge that all of the Australian loudspeakers manufacturing companies had an edge over their imported competition because we were ahead of the game in every way in that regard. And it made a huge huge difference to the quality of our product.
Hmm.
Yeah, clearly, absolutely. And I have another question which I've forgotten, so I'll hand over to Brad for a second while I find it. Where you go, Brad.
So in that advantage set, and you can interrupt any time, Andrew, so the advantage you feel, Ralph, what else did we have? Well, then what else do you feel that Australian designers, manufacturers had as an advantage? Just that, you know, that sort of, how would you describe that?
Is that a question to me or to Brad?
That was me talking to you, Ralph.
Who's me?
God, this feels like so 1980s, Ralph. I do remember. Now I remember. I do remember meeting you. Now it was our eyes sort of met across a bevy of loudspeaker cabinets, and I just knew it was on from then on. What was our so called advantage? That's what I'm attempting to ask.
I don't know. Bluff.
chutzpah.
Bravado. Capacity for great amount of punishment, condescension. I don't know, a willingness to have a go.
I think the willingness, really, the willingness to have a go, I think is, I mean, it's, I think it is, it's got to be part of it. I mean, you touched on the fact earlier that you would walk into a store and allude to a product being made in Australia and you would not be well received. Is that what happened initially?
I got laughed out of a few stores.
Wow.
And worse still, I remember one store in particular where they weren't laughing at me. They were sneering.
Wow.
They were condescending, which was far more painful than being sneered at or ridiculed openly. It was that sort of quite snobby, superior type attitude. So you have to be pretty resilient. And but Brady was a great mate because we used to bolster each other up and encourage each other and help each other constantly. And it was, that really gave me a lot more courage than I might have otherwise have had. It was hard. You had to really keep at it. Really had to keep on flogging away.
Yeah, Ralph, was that a Sydney-based store where they sneered at you? May I ask?
Yes,
because I had a similar sneer. It might be the same shop, but. Very interesting, because this was a particular shop that sold a lot of English loudspeakers. And I was told by the owner that I was most welcome to come in with my prototype, because I was getting my cabinets and speaker stands made by an old English gentleman that looked like, he looked sort of almost like Winston Churchill. And yeah, he used to have a, seriously, Len Richards, the marvellous, marvellous Len Richards. He was an Englishman who I think was in the Navy. He was a photographer in the Navy in the Second World War. And he used to have a cigarette dangling from his mouth. And just the ash, he perfected the art of having ash that didn't fall off. Now, that's not a cigar. This is a cigarette. And I was always amazed while he's sort of doing cabinet sort of assembly. He could make crossovers up. And Len Richards knew this particular character, another Englishman who owned this shop. And he used to make speaker stands for him. And I had lunch with Len Richards and this particular character. And the guy said, the bloke said, bring the speakers up. I'm happy to hear what you're doing with Len. And so I took them up with the crossover on the outside, foolishly. And because that way you can adjust it. Oh no, he pulled my pants down metaphorically. Oh yes, he and another bloke they just tore strips on me, how not professional it was. You know, Australians are never going to be able to design a speaker like the English. And I was supposed to leave the shop with my tail between my legs. Now, the fact that I haven't got a tail per se, but I did feel like I should wrap the tail around myself and strangle myself initially. But then I thought, no, call me old-fashioned, Ralph. What happens when that people do that to you? You say, fuck you, pardon my language, and I'm going to just keep going. So you have a harder crack. So we'll discuss it off air, but I'm pretty sure, did I just say off air?
we're going to make it a radio show in the future.
Yeah, we're making it. Well, we'll discuss it off air to see if it's the same person, but by jingy, it did work to our advantage, Ralph, and it's about, the show's about you, not about me, but on the, Len Wallace Audio and this particular guy used to have alternate weeks of in the Pink Guide advertising their stuff, doing their stuff. And then this particular fellow was bagging Australian loudspeakers. And then Len Wallace would in the following week say how good Richter was or Orpheus was. So I love the fact that we actually sort of got some benefit out of it. So I'm going to stop talking and you take over now, Andrew.
Well, I'll let Ralph take over actually, but because I'm interested to hear how many years, Ralph, you had to drive around banging your head against hi-fi shop doors or walls or the owners to get some to get something happening. I'm guessing that you got a few supportive people initially, but
Andrew Goldfinch was the guy that owned a hi-fi shop in Cremorne.
Yeah,
and also in the city.
Okay,
and Andrew was very good to me. In the first year or so, he was very good to me and very, very encouraging. He took me under his wing,
okay,
to a certain extent, and yeah, that made a big difference. But in regard to the English speaker thing, I recall when I was buying my first set of speakers in about 1975, I went to a hi-fi store, one of about 3 million on Kent Street in Cranston at that point.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed with the reputation of the Kef Concerto, actually.
Okay.
And it had had rave reviews from British reviewers. And I listened to it and I thought, oh, it doesn't really do anything for me. Yeah. There's nothing in that speaker that I like. It doesn't excite me or interest me much. But the reviews were so positive, I thought, oh, I must be wrong.
Yeah.
And I bought a kit, a Kef Concerto kit, speaker, put it together, and I proved to be right. It just had no interest in me at all. This didn't do a darn thing for me, and I thought, well, what's all the fuss about, you know? And around about the same time, I bought a pair of Coral speakers. They were coaxial 8CX50, I think they were.
Mm.
On my second set, the first set that I bought were when I was 12. And I mounted them in a box, and they just sounded magnificent. They were alive. They were natural. They were alive. And they were interesting. They were really involving. You just wanted to listen to more and more music.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's the kind of speaker that I want to listen to. And so from that point, I really I didn't have a very high regard for a lot of the British speakers. I thought they were a bit like stirring your porridge. if you like porridge, wonderful. But if you like music, you could probably do better. That's a bit of a gross generalization. There were some goodies there amongst them. But I thought a lot of the English reviews were rather pompous and had a rather inflated view of their own, their own product.
I think there would be many people who would agree. And I guess, without going off on too much of a technical sort of in a technical direction, but do you think that the way they went about the crossover, where they had priorities related, I don't know, more to low coloration and somewhere along the line, due to the lack of decent available, I guess, software and measurement systems at the time, they were prioritizing the wrong things, and you clearly had priorities elsewhere, which the Corals were doing it for you. But is that part of it, do you think? Is it the kind of crossover design, or what do you have thoughts on?
They forgot to listen to their speakers.
Well, that could be it. Maybe they were peering at their instruments too much. Yes, yeah.
It was a minor oversight, but I think it was an important one nevertheless.
I do. It's funny you say concertos, because Concertos, there's still a strong following for them, and I have on one occasion heard them sound good, but on so many occasions, I don't know, and I put it down to age, but they have quite a weird thing in the mid-range that's quite unpleasant, and sort of a sharp edge and a distinct weirdness in the mid, I never quite warmed to them much as yourself, except this one pair once that sounded really good, but I have no real idea what that was about. I mean, maybe there was two different versions of the crossover. I mean, Kef, you know, I guess they had multiple iterations.
The drivers themselves were brilliant.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. The discrete components were wonderful. But what I noticed was that I've always liked to play music loud, and I cranked them up, you know, to get them to, give a bit of live sound levels. And then all of a sudden there was this amazing crack out of the speaker. And then a little bit later, crack.
Okay.
Like a snapping sound. I thought, yes. Goodness gracious me, what on earth was that?
that might be called our English indigestion, mate.
So I guess...
Granny, do you know what it was?
I assume the voice call former hitting the back of the magnet.
No, it wasn't.
Really?
Oh, right.
Oh.
Holy snapping arseholes. What was it, Ralph? They were suspended. In suspense.
The strong pause to build tension. Yeah, way you go, Ralph.
The pause is a dramatic pause. it's meant to intensify the tension in the conversation.
Well
it's done. Me. It's done that.
You've piqued our interest. You've definitely piqued our interest.
Elevate the general level of anxiety that you're feeling because you can't answer the question.
Oh, I don't care whether I have no idea. What was it, Ralph?
I may not answer it. I'm not sure.
Here we go.
No, okay, I'll give it.
This is the sort of stuff, Andrew, that used to happen when Ralph would say, Brad, would you like to come down for a design day, which is normally a frolic around his office and his factory, sort of on two chairs with wheels, and us sort of attempting to sort of modify drivers, then falling about laughing when something would fly off the cone because Ralph had overdriven the driver. So anyway, stop. Back to you, Ralph.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll answer the question. the bass driver was crossed over quite low, and it used a tiny, tiny little ferrite inductor.
Mm.
And the ferrite inductor was saturating.
Oh,
and when it
God.
Reached saturation point, it went crack.
Is that right?
Wow.
And
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happened was that I removed the inductor and replaced it with, you know, an air coil version. And all of a sudden, bingo, we had dynamics, we had distortion free, and no cracking. So that was just a little thing that happened to me in about 1975. And I realized at that early stage that inductor quality was a very critical thing in both dynamics, distortion, and of course, when a ferrite saturates, it changes its value dramatically.
Mm. Wow!
What was happening with a lot of the designs was that they were fine if you wanted to play them at pussy level. But if you wanted to crank it up at all, what would happen is that the ferrites would start fluctuating in their actual values. And as the current built up in the ferrite, so too would the value of the ferrite deviate from its theoretical nominal value. So that would mean that the crossover points are also wandering all over the place like a loose goose. So that strange mid-range sound that you heard, that disconnected mid-range sound that you heard in the Keith concerto.
Yeah, yeah.
Due to the fact that the crossover points were wandering all over the place like a hairy goat.
Okay. Well, that's probably it, because it may well be that the one that sounded all right that I heard, someone had, you know, maybe...
upgraded it.
Maybe you, Ralph, had put some air cord inductors in there. I don't know. That's I do remember those inductors, though. They were tiny, weren't they? They were literally like a piece of ferrite out of an AM radio antenna. You know, short little sort of, I don't know,
yeah, sure.
2-inch long slug of ferrite that had, you know, not a hell of a lot of wire wound around it. I mean, obviously the core was working very well, very effectively to generate at least statically a larger value. But yeah, obviously saturated extremely easily. But I had no idea that you could get that kind of effect. From obviously complete saturation, but I guess when it fully saturates, its value changes to what? To very low inductance or some kind of weird, I don't know. What do you think happens at full saturation?
Sounds like shit.
Yep.
Cracking shit. Like a whip.
Exactly.
That's an amazing story, Ralph. An important time for it to happen in the 70s, mid-70s. Quality of components, in other words.
Yeah.
Crossover components.
A company called Rifa, R-I-F-A. Everything was made in Australia in those days, you know, and we got the most magnificent capacitors from a company called Rifa.
Mm-hmm.
And... they were great. They were metallized polypropylene capacitors, and they just sounded so good compared to the English little bipolar things that they used to shove in. But I must admit, I had as much contempt for some of the English speakers as they had contempt for mine. So, it went both ways, I guess. It allowed me to withstand the condescension and the insults. You had to be pretty brazen. And I know that Brad suffered the same thing. They treated you as a kind of a miscreant, no-hoping misfit when you wandered into their store.
Well, you know, to some degree, you know, some things haven't changed in a way. I mean, at the moment, it's, so you started, Ralph, at a time when Australian manufactured speakers were not a thing, really. They were just proper ones, were just, thanks to yourself and Brad and I guess Colin Whitmer and a couple of others were just kicking off. And so you were going into uncharted territory. And I guess, you know... to some degree, that's the way it's been for the last few years, where the industry has slowly wound down, as all of Australian manufacturing largely has, with the demise of lots of serious manufacturing, such as obviously motor cars. You know, it's actually a similar time. It's not as bad as when you started, because there's history to show that, of course, you can be successful manufacturing loudspeakers here, but there wasn't at your stage. I mean, you were something of a pioneer, really. I mean, in reality, what loudspeakers were sold? I mean, I know there were loudspeakers manufactured in the 70s, but they were slightly more of the banger variety, I guess. Is that a correct thought?
I should clarify that it's very hard to... some people to understand what the marketplace was like in those days. And during the 60s, the Australians made a multitude of televisions, amplifiers, transistor radios. There were a lot of electronic manufacturers in Australia.
Absolutely.
And similarly, there were a lot of loudspeakers made in Australia. I mean, when I say a lot, an inconceivably huge number of speakers were made in Australia. Because in those early days, I remember when I was 12, I bought a stereo test record. I just bought my first stereo at the age of 12. And it comprised a ping pong ball bouncing from left to right speaker.
Yes.
And returning from the right speaker back to the left speaker. And we used to listen to this for hours on end. And everybody became obsessed with stereophonic,
yeah,
stereophonic high fidelity, you know. And everyone had to have a set. And so what happened was that in at least four that I know of factories in Sydney alone, during the late 60s and 70s, there were fairly large factories pumping out speakers on sometimes 24-hour shifts.
Yeah.
There was a big Philips factory over at Cogra. There was Colmort over at Liverpool.
Yep.
There was a speaker company called Chadwick, and people don't remember Chadwick.
No, I do. That rings a bell. Yeah.
Goodness me, they had all this automated machinery for making cabinets. The machine would feed the sheet of particle board onto the thing. It would be cut all in one hit. All the cuts would be performed at once. All the holes would be cut. And then it would be folded up and made into a speaker in no time flat.
Yep.
It was the most incredible time. There were literally tens of thousands of speakers going out into the marketplace. There was no computers, so everyone was buying a stereo. And so there were, but the trouble was that nearly all of them sounded ghastly.
That was the catch.
And the word ghastly is about appropriate for that age. You don't hear ghastly anymore, but I tell you what, Ralph, that was used back then. So there were some pretty nasty things out there.
Yeah, so that turned like people like myself and Brad into a huge advantage, because these speakers were often the first purchase these people had made, and they were looking for something better. They're out shopping for something better. And we just sort of fell at that moment in time when it was fortuitous. There's no doubt about it, that Australians were ready to buy something better. And we just fell in that moment where buying Australian was also a favoured idea. And that was our advantage. And I think it might be almost like one in a million event where all these things coincided, and it worked to our advantage. It was just a brilliant time to stumble into the market. And so we stumbled around the market, and we kind of I didn't know what I was doing half the time. I had no idea, really, how to market or how to do anything, really. I just sort of kept at it. And bit by bit, one of the things that I did get early in the piece was some very, very good test gear. I had a MLSSA test system.
Yeah.
Which was very, very sophisticated. And even today, there's not a lot that would...
Melissa, it's commonly called.
Yeah, Melissa. Yeah. And it was brilliant. And I think that would have made, with the LEAP program that we were using, which was based on Small Teal's pioneering work, we had the technology to probably be better than most of the imported speakers. Most of the overseas companies were still using, what do they call them? The Neutrik. It was a bar.
Neutrik chart recorder.
A chart recorder, exactly. That's the kind of technology they were still using. Whereas we had this we were actually ahead in our technology, and we were able to, I think, put out a better quality product because of that. That was certainly one aspect of the equation anyway.
Andrew here from Delacorde Loudspeakers. Yeah, that was me talking, interviewing Ralph, and now I'm doing my own ads. It's a low-budget operation. We'll be at the show, the Australian Hi-Fi Show, the Stereo Net Show at the Pullman Hotel, Albert Park, Melbourne, in a few days' time. Please drop into the room, 2204. We'll have our new model on display, which we are very happy with. It's something a little different. It sounds delightful, I think, but of course, you know, highly biased opinion, but, come by, have a listen. And, of course you'll see, Brad Serhan wandering around the show, taking interviews, etc. Feel free to speak to him. He will record your wise words and we may put them to air. So, if you're at the show, please, you know, speak to us, drop into the room and have a great time.
Brad and I used to get in the car at Sydney.
Yeah.
Remember that first Hi-Fi show in Melbourne? We would talk the whole way. And when we got to Melbourne, we would talk till 4 a.m. in the morning, go to bed, talk for the next 3 days, 12 hours a day, jump in the car, drive all the way home and talk all the way home.
Yes, we did.
It's one of the skills that Brad and I had developed very mainly with the ability to talk.
Prone to prolixity, loquacious, all those bullshit words. We marinated in them.
Unfortunately, we never developed the skill of talking sensibly.
I'm not commenting. Is it okay, Andrew, to tell a little story about that trek to Melbourne? The first Hi-Fi show we did together. Well, I think it was our first Hi-Fi show.
Vasey Stocks. Oh, please tell the story about Vasey Stocks.
Well, there's another story that got us to Vasey Stocks.
You have permission. Proceed.
Thank you, sir. And you could always, you know, cut it out. So Ralph and I, we thought we're going to give the Melbourne market a good old crack. And we decided to do the Melbourne Hi-Fi show. Now, this is 1989, and we happened to go down when there was we had the show war. There was the show wars, Hi-Fi show wars, where two people were putting on, or two, what do you call people? Let's say people were putting on the shows on the same weekend.
Oh, the same weekend. So, okay.
Yes.
That is a show war. That's.
Yeah. And we chose this particular one, which was being housed, for want of better words, in a GPS school, a private school.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful grounds and that sort of thing. So Ralph and I got packed up his trailer and put my kid in it and his kid in it. And we got these light blue Toyota Corona, the one which handled quite well, if I remember rightly, but when Toyota suddenly decided to do an RTS thing like Holden did. So Ralph had this sort of wonderful old Toyota Corona, and we drove to Melbourne and we did a lot of talking. And I said, Ralph, what about accommodation as we got in the car? What are we going to do about accommodation? Because we hadn't planned that. And Ralph said, oh, Brad, don't worry about that. I've got an old girlfriend I know we can stay with, and she'll be fine with that. I said, you sure? He said, yeah. No worries, mate. No worries. Anyway, off we went, and it's not your sort of modern-day drive to Melbourne, no traffic lights like we've got now. It's sort of the Hume Highway and over bumpy roads and whatever. Let me tell you, Ralph's a very, very skilled driver.
Okay.
And no one can throw a Toyota Corona circa 1983 or 82 with a trailer on the back into a corner like Ralph and get it through the corner, just getting the apex right with the trailer hanging out the back beautifully poised to slingshot you around the corner, a little bit like NASA taking a spaceship from Saturn to Uranus, or Uranus. Anyway, so we finally get to Melbourne. It's late, and I said, Ralph, what's happening with the with your friends? So we had to find a public phone. It's pre-mobile phones, and he rings her, and she now has a boyfriend, which meant that, unfortunately, she wasn't very, well, I don't think she was too excited by the fact that she might have Ralph staying with a friend. And, no, I've got a boyfriend now, Ralph. It's not possible. So we look at each other, where the fuck are we going to stay? But fortunately, we were able to get into the old school building, and we found our room. And I don't think we took all the gear up at that stage, but we had sleeping bags and stuff with us. And they had benches outside the schoolrooms. But unlike public schools, these private schools had padded benches. Very lucky. And so we were able to sort of camp down on that. And I thought, gee, this is just, this is what I call quality living. You know, this is just superb. It's like camping out with a fucking airbed. It's just superb. You can't get better than that. It's called glamping. We were glamping in this private school. And Ralph, funnily enough, I'm settling down, it's late. It's really late at this stage, and we'd been talking too much. And Ralph thought, geez, I've worked up a sweat here, so I might go and have a shower. Okay. So off he went. And I'm sort of starting to sort of go off to sleep, and next minute I hear these fire alarms go off. And then next minute I see all this what looks like smoke, and then I hear the and that's the fire trucks arriving.
Yeah.
What in fuck's name is going on? And next minute I see Ralph with a towel around him, quasi-naked, as you tend to be when you have a shower. He'd had a hot shower because it was very cold. And there's so much steam, it triggered the fire alarms. But Ralph, I'll let you take out because from your point of view, you were in the shower.
It was not a moment in my life. I was having a lovely hot shower at something like 4 a.m. in the morning. And then two burly firemen charged into the room. into the bathroom with me. And I thought, this is just a bit too close for comfort, you know? You're supposed to put out fires, not put out showers. Well, they got it back to front. Anyway, I was very confused. I thought, what's going on here? Maybe I'd got into some sort of gay dress-up party or something.
And you'd forgotten your fire brigade YMCA officer uniform.
Style. Very exciting, Ralph.
Yeah. So anyway, eventually the whole misunderstanding was ironed out. But that was just a typical scenario that wherever Brad and I went, we seemed to attract chaos. Actually.
So that's a wrap on part one of the Not an Audiophile interview with Mr. Ralph Waters, the founder of Richter Acoustics, ably assisted in this case with Brad and myself, Andrew Hutchison. So thanks again for listening. Please like, follow, subscribe, all of that sort of stuff. It really helps to move the podcast along. Reviews are great. Feedback, comments, etc. on the YouTube versions of these videos, or they're not videos, no. Audio only podcast, but they are on YouTube and comments can be left there. I'd love to hear what you think, either positive or negative. I mean, probably positive is preferred, but we're certainly open to critiquing. No one's perfect. And of course, see you at the Melbourne Hi-Fi Show, which is on any day. And of course, part two of this interview with Ralph will be up soon.